at session number 31558, reel 6.
But it was possible. And before Normandy, I was sent off to do, first of all, I did a course on the Merlin engine, which is the same as the RAF Meteor engine, but it was not supercharged. And then I did a course on, it was on several court-martial cases. One was somebody who dropped a Sten gun into a Cromwell engine and broken the engine and not damaged the Sten gun. And he was certainly, I think, ought to have had a charge against him and been court-martialed for careless like that. But one had written something to his girlfriend about things he was going to do when Normandy came. And he didn't really give me any secrets away. And he was so keen to get into the thing. He was obviously hadn't been in the desert. And he wasn't my regiment. He wasn't 4th COY. He was one of the other regiments in the division, I think, 7th Armoured. And so he, I felt, really was innocent. Basically, the brigadier wouldn't have sent him to be court-martialed unless he wanted him to be found guilty. And obviously he is guilty, because he'd written these letters, or this letter. So I just hoped that he didn't get... I said, can't we put in something on a bit of compassion for him, because he's the right sort of person we want. But whether that worked, I didn't know, because he wasn't my regiment anyhow. But then after that, somebody said that there was a secret camp up at Hokum in Norfolk, where they were teaching people to fire 17-pounder Shermans, Fireflies, in fact. It was the code name. And they were firing out to sea, and there was talk about some damage to one of the tanks. Well, when I got there, the thing got completely wrong. It wasn't damage. I got there on a Saturday, and that's right, I got there on a Saturday and found there was really nothing. A spanner had got lost and a few tools through carelessness, but nothing else. And so I got the drivers together and the crews on these tanks who were there. Well, people, the gunners from the different regiments in the division came up and fired so they get experience with fireflies. And I found that there were a number of things that were going wrong, and one was a split pin that kept breaking, getting lost somewhere on the breech. I don't know whether it was the pin split securing breech, securing actuating shaft, securing breech, whatever. It was one of those things. And I wrote a letter to the brigade and giving this list of things. And they took it seriously because those faults were remedied before D-Day. And I stayed there after that. They said, well, you might as well stay here because there's not much for you to do before we get mobilized. And so I stayed there. And then suddenly, one day, a major came up from the War Office to see me, and I was still in bed at 8 o'clock in the morning because I had nothing to do. And the ranger officer was a 4th COY officer who was in charge of all that sort of thing on the range, and I had nothing. So I was just going around keeping my eyes open for anything going wrong with the guns, really, because having been a gunnery instructor, I knew a little bit about guns. And so if I got any good marks from the brigade for having sent this report in, I lost the war, because I'm sure this major would come all the way up from London and finding me still in bed at 8 o'clock in the morning when he got the 6 o'clock train. Must have felt he was a very dissolute young man. Anyway, suddenly I was told, bring the barrels back from the fireflies because they're all worn out. And so we loaded them onto a 3-ton lorry and took them back. And then I was told to bring the tanks. Then I was told to bring them with the tank another time, to bring some tanks back for maintenance, and then they were taken back. And I just had a 3-ton lorry that I used to run around in and took them back. And then there was orders to bring all the tanks back, so I knew that it was something important starting at last. So I got them on, and one of the drivers hadn't filled up with petrol. So I hadn't got enough petrol to get back to the regiment at Hayash camp. And by that time, I was outside Ipswich. No, I think it was either Hayash or Ipswich. Anyway, I went into the next door, 79th Armored Division, and said, can you let me have so many gallons of petrol? And there was a MP sergeant there. And he said, yes, certainly. But you, how do we get them to you? You can't come in. And you can't have them until we get a lorry free to bring them, so you'd have to wait. But I knew I couldn't get them back in time before it was dark. And they wanted them that day. So eventually I got rather cross. I said, all right, then I'll drive in if you don't trust my driver. And so he still was demurred on this. So I got very irritated with him. So I said, anyway, you're supposed to be very secret, but everybody knows about your wretched swimming tanks. We know we've got also secret weapons we're testing. And so then he was a bit surprised, and that's all I heard of it. But when I did get back to the regiment, somebody came up on a machine gun and said, how did you know about these? Oh, the sergeant said, how did you know about swimming tanks? So I said, well, it was in the Daily Mirror, in the Sunday Pictorial. And he said, no, it wasn't. It was in the what was the paper there? Daily Mail. Not the Daily Mail, the Sunday one. That they give all the scandal about. Always gave scandal in it. Anyway, so he knew where the leak had been. That's where I heard it from. Not because Dong was working with them. When Dong came back, he said, what's this I hear about you shooting your mouth off in a pub about swimming tanks? I said, I never did that. And he said, I knew you wouldn't have done. But that's what I was told. Somebody came up from security and said, that's what you've done. So they really had followed up the thing quite finding out who did I know who was in that. And of course, it was absolutely innocent. I didn't know at all. It was because everybody knew about it from this leak in the newspapers. Anyhow, how far have I got now? That's answered the question, isn't it? About what we were doing. Then I went back to the regiment and I was back there. We were waterproofing the tanks by that time with black oil which stuck on black paint. And then there was a pond in the forest where we had to take them through to see if it worked. Well, when it came to our HQ tanks, the pond had been turned into mud, and the bottom pretty well had to tow one tank after the other because they were grinding on the bottom, and everyone had to be re-waterproofed afterwards. I said, this is absolutely stupid. We're wasting the time. We'd better spend that time in being more careful with the waterproofing. Anyway, nobody's going to be casual over a thing like that. But, oh no, we had to do it, so I got into disgrace over that too. And then we had a big final party at Ipswich, outside Ipswich where we were, and on June the 3rd, I think it was, we formed up the whole division on the road leading to Felixstowe. And I remember the nights before when we'd been in the park, Orwell Park, with the headquarters in the big house. When you had the evening off, we used to go into Ipswich to a party or a pub or something. We'd walk back. It was walking distance. We could walk back, and the hedges were full of nightingales singing all the way along. I'd never heard anything like that. And then they had to form up on this day. I think it was the 3rd of June. On every tank place was marked with its number, the tank and so on, and the fireflies and so, and they were well on it. And we moved out on the very early that night into our places on the road, and we went on at night without lights on the tanks, just to see the dim light of the tank in front, the rear light. and we went through Felixstowe, and as soon as it got light, we landed on the landing craft, and we moved up the two rivers there. We moved up them. I think I moved up my one, went up the southern one. We weren't put very much in order necessarily. We went on so that if the RHQ was on four tanks, and then one of the tanks and one of the squadrons would take up the ninth place. Anyhow, we got on. We were there for a couple of days, and then morale went low because rumour went on that the people who went on the Dieppe raid had been on their landing craft for a fortnight before they sailed, and that did depress people because it was very, very cramped there. You had to sleep on top of the tanks. There was no room between them or beside them, and we didn't like the idea of being a fortnight. But in actual fact, it was a couple of days, I think. And on the morning of the 5th, we sailed. Every landing craft had a balloon on it, and quite a number caught round the balloons of other landing craft, and then they let go and went up into the sky at immense height and burst, and the bits came down. But they always had plenty of spare balloons, which would stop dive bombers or reconnaissance planes coming very close. And then we sailed round from Ipswich, from Felixstowe, the following morning, in a huge, great armada of landing craft. I don't remember many landing ships. They seemed to come in a bit later. But the landing craft, we were all in landing craft, all ones around us. And we went right round the coast to almost as far as Portsmouth, I think, although we couldn't see the shore. We were out in the middle of the channel and going round, and then away from the shore. And then we turned south, and we were told to arrive. By that time, we were fully briefed. We knew where they were given maps and things like that. We knew that the advance was going to be 50 div, which had been with the regiment with our division, 7th Armoured in Italy. And they were the assault. We were to be the follow-up, and the rest of the division was to be the rest of our corps, I suppose, were to be the rear guard or the follow-up. We were the build-up. Are you getting cold? Well, it was we thought we were going ashore that evening anyway, and it was very picturesque. For lunchtime, you could see smoke going up, and we got nearer and nearer. We saw that the smoke was immense flames and fire. And when we got right to landing, we were told it's too late to land now, we'd have to go ashore at first light tomorrow. So we had a rather uncomfortable night lying on the tank again. And when we got up in the morning, we had to seal the driver in, and with this Bostik black tarry stuff we had to use. And when my tank came down, I was the second on the tank on the right-hand side. So the first one went in, then the next two, I was the fourth tank in the water. And we had a shoot-up for the engine, for the exhaust, and for me, for the commander to see so he could guide the driver. Well, the driver turned a bit left, and the water got deeper and deeper till it was about, the waves when they were coming up were about 6 inches from the top of the thing. And I was very frightened. I think, turn left, and he didn't answer. So I tapped the loader wireless operator and told him to indicated to him, and he did. And the driver turned left. We climbed out all right. And when I got on shore, I said, "What on earth happened? Why are you doing that?" And he said, "Well, the water was sheeting in onto my wireless set, and I couldn't hear what you were hearing, that sound." And it had been very rough, you know, that day of D-Day. And a big wave had hit our thing and come over it and wetted my tank, because I know it was mine specially, because Arthur, the colonel, had come down. He was on the bridge of the tank, and he came down was talking to me, and we were looking at the flames and smoke and so on the shore, and he was very angry because he got soaked, and so did I. And so that was, I know that it was my tank had got the worst of that wave, because nobody else had, no other driver had that trouble. It was just bad luck, I think. Anyway, we did get out in time, and we came up and climbed up a fairly steep hill, and then at the top of the hill we took off all this Bostik and the chutes and so on, and moved into a field, and the other people came up. At the top of the hill I saw 88 millimeter, the old-fashioned ones with the ground mounting, and had been knocked out, and we came up actually just a little bit to the east of Aramanche, and we came up there. We went into a field, and we had 2 days, I think, with nothing happening at all there.
Which had been your designated beach?
Jig Green, but it wasn't Jig Green. The Wavy Navy crew of our land craft had got the beach wrong. But it was rather a good thing, because some people who did land on the right beach did go in too deep, and they came up wearing German clip pullovers and things, because they got soaked in getting out of the tanks, and they had to wait until the tanks could be pulled out and dried out, I suppose. But they weren't always necessarily even from our lot, but those were false sharpshooters.
What had been the morale of the general atmosphere in the unit, like before, immediately before the invasion?
Immediately before, it was rather bad, because everybody was saying no leave, no second front. They thought they ought to have leave, and they were saying no second front, no invasion, no second front, no leave, no second front. That was it. And I don't know who was our regiment who wrote it up, but anyway, some people did that. And Arthur Cranley, Colonel Cranley, called everybody together on one occasion, and he said, "You may not like these Cromwell tanks," and people didn't, because if you traversed the turret more than 45 degrees, the driver couldn't bail out, which was the same fault as with the Crusaders. So it ought to have been put right. And they originally had 6-pound anti-tank guns, and instead of which they put in 75 millimetres. They had solid shots, but they far too low muzzle velocity to do any damage to a German tank. And so the people were not very satisfied. But I was very pleased with mine, because despite these faults, it was so much better than the Crusader that I felt quite happy with it. Also, the armour on the front was quite thick, almost as thick as a Sherman's armour, but it was vertical, so things could come through the front quite easily, front of the turret, whereas with the Sherman it was a little bit at an angle, and with the Mark IV Special, which is most of the German tanks were, it was at an angle. Tigers was frontal to it, but whereas was what, inches and a half, I think. Tigers about 6 inches, so our shots couldn't get to a Tiger anywhere. The only damage you could do to a Tiger with a 75 pound was, I suppose, possibly if you hit the track, you might damage the track. Otherwise, they were invulnerable to us.
What were the Cromwells like inside?
Oh, they were very comfortable. But once we got inside, after Villers-Bocage, we had one set to talk to the crew and one set to talk to the squadron. And they put in another wireless set to talk to the infantry as well, so that they could go to the hedges and see if it was clear before we came out in these little fields of the Bocage. But that was absolutely hopeless. It never would have worked, because it's not possible for one human being to command a tank, command a troop, keep in touch with their own squadron, and talk to infantry with another wireless set at the same time. I think it was too much. Anyhow, but that was after Villers-Bocage we did that, because I'm going to tell you about that next. At first we were in this field and we were Messerschmitt by, we were machine gunned from the air by Focke-Wulfs. but they were not very effective, and they were really quite way off. Even the shooting, the quality was gone off a lot from what it had been in the desert earlier on. And I got hay fever rather badly, which I hadn't had since before the war, and so I was not all that comfortable. And then after that, the RAF dropped masses of leaflets saying, to the written in French, saying, leave the towns, you're in danger, and so on. So after a couple of days there, I suppose it was about the 8th of June, we moved through Bayeux, and then we started down the divisional centre line, which was the road down to Tilly-sur-Seur. We went through Bayeux, and the Gommels went ahead, and the Fireflies, and it was very sticky. I saw on the road some Mark IV specials had been knocked out, a machine gunner, a motorcyclist, dispatch rider, dead German one, beside his thing. And we stopped one day in a hollow with a dead horse in the middle at Jerusalem crossroads, and the horse had been dead for a couple of days because it was very smelly. And every time I got out of the tank to spend a penny, a sniper, German, sniped at me from a wood about, as far as I remember, it was about 75 yards away. Because we got very good at judging distances, both in the desert and because you had to tell the distance to the gunner how far, what the distance was. And now I've been, more recently, I've been facing things out and getting back to being able to judge distances. But it's all useless now with satellite navigation. But then it was quite important. So I knew how far he was. And so I went off with I think I had a machine gun, I forget which, and I brought one of the gunner, maybe it was a Sten gun, he had another one as well. And I tried to get to him. I waited until it was almost dark, and I could so I could be able to see him against the sky, the skyline of the top of the tree, where I guessed he was, because from where the bullets were coming. And I didn't think that if we were going very carefully, he would be able to see us. But in fact, he must have been able to, because every time he moved, he shot and missed. So he wasn't a very good shot. So I gave it up and came back to the tank. And the next morning, they moved on a bit further, and A squadron were leading then, and no, C squadron led then, and because one troop got knocked out, and I remember seeing it afterwards, the tanks had caught fire, and the members of the crew were in it and been badly burnt. Some had been taken out and buried, some were, there was one whose head and legs had gone, just his body and his hand would look perfectly normal. It was a nasty thought. The people who happened to be washed out of tanks. That was what I thought was the worst thing, to be washed out of a tank. Anyway, I still wasn't, I was a little bit more, less careless about things than I'd been before, because I could see how horrid it was compared with the desert, where you could see what was going, these nasty surprises. The first person in the regiment to be killed was Lieutenant Moxon in A Squadron. And he always had he thought he was going to be killed. And he was killed by accident when a shell from our support had landed and hit a tree behind him and exploded, and a bit of shrapnel had come down and hit him and killed him. Anyway, by the time these three tanks were knocked out, there was more trouble. And there was another bit where Cromwell said, while it's back, you could see a Panzer tank in front, not more than about 50 yards. And the Panzer hadn't seen him and he couldn't really make it out to know where to shoot at it. But he thought if he could have shot the tracks or something, or got it to the base of the turret, he might have done some damage. And then somebody else started shooting at the Panther, and the Panther fired at him and knocked out this Cromwell. And I talked to the driver, who was very frightened, because they did so much damage. Because the Panthers didn't have an 88, but they had a gun with a 75mm gun with a narrowing bore, so it had a very high muzzle velocity. But we knocked out quite a lot of Panthers later on, I think. And then I was very thankful when we were pulled back to Jerusalem Crossroads and told to take the road to the west, and the idea was to go behind behind Tilly and back to the main road and carry on there to Villers-Bocage and occupy point 213 or whatever its number was. And so we were pulled back and we got on some of the way, but not all of it, because we were, every time we came to a village, the tanks stopped and the infantry had to go in. And people said, because of exaggeration, that the first village, the company went in, the second village, a platoon went in, the third village, they didn't get quite so many casualties as that, the section went in and they hadn't come out, but there was quite a lot of trouble. And then we got as far as a place called Livry. We called it like this without very good French pronunciation, and we had to stop at the night there. Just before we got there, we saw one of these attacks, and the colonel of the rifle brigade stopped and I said, would you like to come and see? Because we had a very good view of it going on in the valley on our left. And he climbed onto the tank and we both sat outside and watched this attack, which went very well. And then when we got to Livry, it was getting dark, and the first tank of the 7th Hussars, which was the brigade reconnaissance regiment, Cromwell, was knocked out by a bazooka by the Germans. And so we stopped the night in Livry. So by the time we settled, it was about midnight, and we had to wake up about 4 to get going again. And the idea was to go through Villers-Bocage. Well, we heard so much about the battle there and the videotape of it, the DVD of it, but at the time, there wasn't any idea of what was going on at all. All I knew, I still had to look after the troop of the regimental headquarters troop. And so that morning we went on, and we pressed on quite well, and we were told that there were no German tanks in Villers-Bocage, as we called it, but that in Tracy-Bocage there had been some stranded without any petrol. And so when we got to Villers-Bocage, the people thought they were liberated, and they gave us a lovely huge great tin of butter, which was quite very much of a luxury in those days, and that was the main thing, I think, and flowers they threw on the tank. So we put them on our tin helmet, on our berries, I mean, which again was another fault, really, that the tank commander wouldn't wear a tin hat because he couldn't have his earphones, wouldn't work. So we had to have berries on. So that's why I think the tank commanders suffered a very high casualty rate. And if they were officers, then they suffered more. So I covered my pips up with mud to make them less conspicuous. Anyway, by that time, I dropped the ranks to lieutenant, so I knew I was going to have to do so sooner or later.
That was because you no longer...
I was surplus to establishment, and I still was, really, when I was put on the RHQ troop leader. And Arthur Cranley put me on that because he thought it was my bad leg that I'd have a bit of trouble, perhaps. And